I'm a bigger man now. Felt a little intimidated there again. Didn't know why until I realized we didn't have the platform up here. Good afternoon to you all, as Aaron would say. I'm kidding him. He got through the first round anyway. I really appreciated Aaron. We had to call on him at the last minute, and appreciate him being able to handle the song service for us today. I don't have to tell you, I'm sure, that the world is falling apart around us, even as we sit here, watching the news on television or reading it in print can be almost overwhelming. In fact, I'm sure that part of my kind of downer mood today, which I'll confess to being in, is a result of the news and of sort of trying to think about it and analyze it and consider where we are in the world. Even the commentators and writers that do it for a living are struggling to keep their equilibrium and their objectivity as they cover the stories that just kind of keep rolling in on us like waves of the sea. Barely get out of one story until you're into the next in terms of the heavy-duty stories that are rocking our world. How thankful we ought to be to know the truth of God about the future of mankind. And how thankful we ought to be to have a framework of prophecy and the very words of Jesus Christ that shows us that there is hope beyond the immediate crises that are racking our world. In Fiery's opening prayer, he said hopefully encouraging words. And I kind of winced because my wife and I had a conversation about the subjects of the sermons from week to week, and when I had mentioned that I was going to talk a little bit about the conditions in the world today, she said, you know, folks really need a lot of encouragement. And I said, I think I'm normally encouraging, but I appreciated her input, and as a result, I decided Chris should go last because Chris is always encouraging. So I'll give you the downer news, and Chris can give you the good news. For what it's worth, I didn't actually even plan to speak on this subject today because it was a split sermon. I was looking at sort of a, what I would call a smaller doctrinal subject that I was planning to present in this split. And then all of a sudden in my head, I kept hearing the congregation saying, the world is falling apart and you're talking about that? Just kind of seemed like it was a little bit out of sync, even though, of course, God's word and God's doctrines are always important. So I decided to talk about what's been on my mind and likely the minds of all of us to some degree, and that is the incredible state of our world. And there's no way to analyze or even cover all the crazy conditions that plague mankind today, and we perhaps have to do that in more depth from time to time. But I want to do something a little different today and just look at some of the highlights of what's happening around us, just from the headlines, if you will, or the major stories that are coming at us day by day. And I haven't gone out and searched any websites or done any great research to do that. I just pulled out of my magazine rack the things that come into my house and the things that, you know, you read as a matter of routine, as a matter of course, in a sense, and not earth-shaking materials by any means. But at the same time, the kind of thing that is going about that shapes our world today. Now, some of us older folks, and I don't include myself in this because I was born during World War II, but some of us lived through World War II and Korea and Vietnam and the Cold War, and we've known lots of concerns and fears in the world, and perhaps we've become a little bit jaded to the reality of what's going on in our world. It seems ironic to me now at my age to think that the fears that we had in the 50s especially and into the 60s of the sudden nuclear war with Russia have recycled all the way around until, even though we don't necessarily expect a nuclear war with Russia tomorrow, we are now talking about openly the fact that we are at least by association at war with Russia through Ukraine. And we never really did come to direct war with Russia, the Cuban Missile Crisis being the closest probably that we came. But today we actually are on the verge of of having a situation where the United States and Russia are directly facing each other in a type, at least, of war. I'm going to start by just sort of thumbing through and reading you some headlines, if you will. And I'm not trying to go anywhere with them except to give you what I have, which is the impression that no matter where we look, things are not so good. Right up front in the world headlines, Israel-Hamas conflict, the search for a ceasefire as the death toll mounts. We all know that. It's happening every day all around us. It's unthinkable on one level, impossible to avoid on another, because of the society in which we live. Another headline, peril in the air, guarding planes from ground-based threats is everybody's job and no one's. Again, the scary part being that no one can possibly guard planes from ground-based threats if somebody chooses to use such a threat at any time. It's the world in which we live. A picture from California of a almost dry drainage, not drainage, but irrigation ditch, with the headline, turning off the tap. Even the governor can't convince Californians to take their drought seriously. Jumping away from the headlines for a moment, that article goes on to point out that a couple of years ago, the governor asked Californians to reduce their water usage by 20%, one-fifth, 20%. They've had a full year, and they've measured the consequences of his encouragement to the citizens to change their water consumption, and the conclusion is that in May of this year, water usage in California was 1% up from the average of the last 3 years. So it did not go down, it went slightly up. And California is 100% of the state is under drought. We're not quite that bad here in Texas, though we've certainly been pretty bad. There's a long article in this, and this is, by the way, the latest Time magazine, which has on the cover a headline, Cold War II, the West is losing Putin's dangerous game. So it's calling it Cold War II. And then there's a series of pictures from the airplane crash, which really wasn't a crash, but a shoot down in the Ukraine, and quotes from the photographer who say it was almost too horrible to take in. The scene was almost too horrible to take in. Now, you see, you're already feeling kind of negative. You're already feeling kind of discouraged and kind of down, and that's just one issue of one magazine. It isn't my intent to completely discourage you, or certainly not to destroy you today, but to help you understand where we are. In a different Time magazine from a couple of weeks ago, an article entitled Blowback, with the heading that with thousands of Westerners fighting for Islamist groups in Syria and Iraq, a foreign jihad no longer seems so distant. In other words, what used to be over there and among those people is now basically a threat to our own shores, along with Europe. Officials fear that some of these fighters may eventually return radicalized by their experience and ready to bring their war home. So we have people of strong extremist religious perspectives who are traveling across the world to fight religious wars, and then who are perfectly acceptable back home with their American or English or German passports and able to travel freely throughout the world, not as terrorists per se, but as common citizens, but who come back home to carry out their war on the home front. That can happen at any time. Again, it's the world in which we live. Moving to a different kind of invasion, again, Time magazine, the only news magazine that I take on a regular basis, even though it's terribly liberal, it gives me a little bit of a window on what's happening and what people are thinking about in the world. This one's entitled Space Invaders, but it's not talking about space. It's not talking about aliens from outer space. It's talking about animals on the planet that have been imported to various places, in particular the United States, by the thousands or hundreds of thousands that don't belong here. At least as far as we know, they don't belong here. Now, there's a certain small number of scientists who will say, well, why can't they belong here as well as anywhere else? The fact that they originated in this case, Burma, the pythons that are mentioned in here, doesn't mean they can't be at home in the United States and that we can't live with them in peace and comfort, I guess. Not something most of you want to look at, but they have a picture of a python here. And I want to quote just a couple of things that are stated here. Let's see. Burmese pythons began appearing regularly in South Florida more than 15 years ago. It is likely that pythons brought in as pets had either escaped or were released into the wild, and then, like so many retirees before them, poor wording, fell in love with the Sunshine State's tropical climate. Today, there may be as many as 100,000 Burmese pythons living amid the wetlands of South Florida. 100,000, though no one really knows. Pythons can disappear when they want to, which is most of the time. Later it says, the pythons, which of course are mostly in the Everglades, can lay up to 100 eggs at a time, grow more than 7 feet in their first 2 years, and now face no natural predators. And of course, it goes on to describe not only the pythons, but the giant snails from Africa and the Asian carp and the various things that are taking over our land and our waters that we can't control and that have no natural predators in our society. So while we go merrily about our day-to-day lives and business and thankfully a positive approach to life and making the best of life and being God's people and being Christians, the world is coming apart at the seams all around us. I'll switch from time to a good old standard AARP magazine. AARP has an article called The American Family, Then and Now. And of course, it documents the changes in American families. Actually, the article is called The New American Family. This chart is called The American Family, Then and Now. And I want to mention the chart to you. It's just two columns of then and now. And it uses 1970 and 2013 as the basis. 1970, 40% of households consisted of a married couple and their children. In 1970, 40% of households consisted of a married couple and their children. In 2013, this is America now, 2013, 19% of households consisted of a married couple and their children. Pretty dramatic, from 40% down to 19 in just that 33-year period. A longer period now, 1960, 72% of adults were married. 1960, 72% of adults were married. In 2012, 51% of adults are married. Now again, this is no personal criticism of anybody who is married or not married or has children or doesn't have children. It's a statement on the kind of society and the fabric of society we live in terms of stability and relationships and long-term expectations. So the married population has gone from almost three quarters to just a half. In 1960, 5% of the births in the country were to unmarried women, 5%. In 2012, you probably couldn't even guess, in 2012, the births to unmarried women were 41%. 1980, 12% of Americans lived in multi-generational households. People took in their parents or parents took in their children. 1980, 12%, 2009, 17%. That's a commentary, of course, partly on the economy, the fact that people cannot afford to live and cannot continue to function in the same way they always have, either able to take care of their parents in their own home or a retirement community, or children able to get a job coming out of college and basically left to fend for themselves, and they go back home. That brings us a little closer to home, which is the Community Impact newspaper that is distributed all over Houston in various regions. This one is the Katy edition. And in the Katy edition, there is a heading on the bottom of the first page that says, luxury neighborhoods, rising values, closing door on affordable housing. Now, everybody likes to see their home value go up. We like to see people building nice, pretty neighborhoods, but not everybody can afford those houses or those pretty neighborhoods. And Houston is beginning to be a place where those who cannot afford that new expensive kind of housing are starting to be shut out because the old housing is being taken down and new housing put up. The old housing is being taken down and new plants or offices being built. And new housing that's being built is generally starting at the $200,000 bracket and up. And I would say way up. It's very easy in the Katy, Cinco Ranch, western suburbs of Houston, very easy to see ads all the time that say from the 400s, from the 500s, from the 600s, they'll start a whole community that starts at the $600,000 bracket. It kind of blows your mind. It's impossible to imagine that many people. We drive through some of these neighborhoods that we're not that far from, and we see the homes and how many hundreds or thousands there are, and we say, how can so many people live in these places? Where does it come from? Of course, a lot of them are living beyond their means. They're living in debt, whatever the case may be, but it is a factor that is affecting the way Americans live. While the economy gets better in one sense, it shuts more people out. Now, I'm not on the president's and other people's wavelength of we should take from all the people who have and give to all those who have not. That's not the principle Christ defines. So I'm not talking about equality in the sense of leveling the playing field by taking from those who have made it and giving to those who have not. But there certainly is a level of concern about the inequality that develops over time and the inability of those people who actually often do the more menial jobs and are required to keep society functioning, who can't afford to live. I used to notice that way back in ski trips we'd take with the college to Vail, Colorado in the early 80s. You go into a place like Vail and everything is expensive and everybody's living high and there's tourists everywhere. But of course, we're all being served by people who are serving food, cleaning toilets, driving buses, sweeping the streets, and they don't make very much money. And they have to live in the same place that all those people who buy the multi-hundred-thousand-dollar condominiums buy. And so you have little enclaves off here in the valleys away from Vail where there are, squalid neighborhoods where people have to live because they can't afford to live among the people they're serving. So it's always been a problem, but it seems to continue to be or begin to be a bigger problem. This one you won't really understand. It's called World War Zero. Anybody read this? World War Zero. I understand nobody reads Time magazine, but World War Zero. And it's a catchy title, of course, but what it's referring to is computer hacking and computer viruses. And without going into a lot of the details, the subtitle on the article is The Code War. The Code War, not Cold War, but The Code War. Kind of catchy, of course. It says, the internet is a battlefield. The prize is your information, and bugs are the weapons. So huge companies are developing now that make their living by finding weaknesses in websites before vicious hackers do. Now, I'm talking industrial espionage especially, but if I've got a website and it's got a vulnerability, there are companies who will work to find that vulnerability and then try to sell the secret to me before I get hacked by somebody who's after my information. Now, that sounds kind of simple, but let me read you a couple of statistics. The number of attacks the average American company fielded in 2013. Companies who have to be ready to deal with people trying to hack into their information, whether it's Target, Chase Bank, McDonald's. Number of attacks the average American company fielded in 2013, according to IBM's security division, was 16,856. If you're a company with any kind of money and any kind of major play in the world, there are people trying to get into your information, get into your website, steal everything from your customer base to your trade secrets, to your financial data, and most websites are vulnerable. So some of these bright kids, as I call them, have developed companies who will spend their time searching for those vulnerabilities in those websites. And of course, they call it World War Zero because the zero represents how old the virus is, or the vulnerability is, sorry, not the virus. This is not a virus, but a vulnerability to a virus, or a vulnerability to a hack, a vulnerability to the information being lost, as it was with Target. The zero refers to the number of days. In other words, they try to sell these things back to the company on the very day they appear on the website. I hope I'm making this somewhat clear. You've got a vulnerability, like in your case, let's use not the computer, but our house. You've got a window that doesn't lock, and you don't know about it, but I discover it, and I come to you and I say, hey, you know, a burglar could break into your house. Now, most of us could go around and check our windows, but a little harder on the computer. But your burglar could break into your house. I'll tell you where the window is or the problem that has if for $10. Except on the computer, it's not for $10, but it's for $100,000 or something of that sort. Google paid out since 2010 as part of its reward program to people finding these vulnerabilities. In other words, I'll pay you to tell me what's wrong with my website if you prove to me that it's vulnerable to hackers. Google paid out since 2010 $3.3 million for that information. The normal rewards range from $100 to $20,000. And one huge bug fetched $150,000 as part of a company hackathon. They invited people to hack their website and paid $150,000 to somebody who broke in to tell them how they got in. So on and on it goes. Code war, that sounds like sort of trivial compared to Israel and Hamas, or compared to the bringing down of a Malaysian airline over rebel-held Ukrainian territory, or over the takeover of a third of Iraq by the ISIS army, or over the 50,000, now many more than that actually, a couple of months ago it was 50,000 young people who had been taken into custody coming into our country across the Mexican border. Those things hit us where we are. The computer thing is sort of esoteric. It's out there. It's something that happens to companies, no big deal. But it can bring down both our economy and our military, not to mention your personal identity if you happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. So we're vulnerable on all of these different levels. And I brought in the housing market and the computer bugs simply to say that we never know where it's coming from. It's all around us. It could be anywhere. We're vulnerable to it. It's the world in which we live, and it's all based on what? Greed, competition, lust, jealousy, vanity, strife, all kinds of carnal attitudes that are all around us in the world, but that we don't necessarily have to deal with on a day-to-day basis. And again, I know when I stand here, a disclaimer here, all of you, virtually all of you, deal with it far more than I have to. My big problems aren't these issues. My big problems are you. No, I'm kidding. But the point is, I get to work among the brethren. I don't have to go out and work in the world. I don't have to go out and argue with people every day about some financial issue or some labor issue or some insurance issue or all the different things that we're dealing with. The closest I get to that is if I don't get a good repair job on my car when I pay good money to get one. I'm not in that field. You are. And I understand that. So you know what the world is like, and you deal with it every day. When I get to the point when I have to get into, vicariously get into circumstances like that through somebody else's life, it actually sometimes shocks me and discourages me and almost blows me away, because I realize what brethren have to deal with day in and day out. And it's a real challenge. It's a real downer to see what people have to do and how they have to live. Again, as I said in the opening statement, how thankful we ought to be that we know that God has a purpose and a plan for all this. Let's go back to Matthew 24. I'm not going to wade through the details of Matthew 24, but certainly the principles are here that we need and that we depend on. Matthew 24, verse 3. Now as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, Tell us, when will these things be? And what will be the sign of your coming to the end of the age? And Jesus answered and said to them, Take heed that no one deceives you, for many shall come in my name, saying, I am the Christ. Take the quotes out of that, because it really means they'll say that he is the Christ, which they're doing today, and will deceive many. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not troubled. Wow. Strong. That's a powerful statement, isn't it? A tough place to be. Our Savior said, See that you be not troubled. I can't say that I've done that very well. I get troubled. I get discouraged. I get frustrated with the way the world goes and the way we have to live, even though I live in relative peace and safety most every day. Again, my biggest dangers are the 100-mile-an-hour people darting by me and cutting me off in traffic. One so dramatically recently, I actually stopped on the freeway because there was a policeman sitting there. And how he missed the guy, I don't know. The guy barely missed me, and he had to be doing 100. I was doing about 70 in the toll road lane and on the 10. And all I saw was like a shooting star coming at me from the back. Guy went around me, but there was a car in the right lane, and I was in the left lane, almost overtaking the car in the right. And I don't sit out there. I go out and pass and get on. I had pulled out there, and with only a few yards between me and the other car, this guy came up behind me, went around and through that space. And I tell you, you know, on a moving car, it's hard to know, but you would think there wasn't a foot between any of us, between him and the other car, between me and him. And no sooner that happened, he went over a little rise. I came over that rise. He had actually disappeared. There was a policeman sitting on the side of the road as if to be, you know, checking traffic or doing a speed trap or whatever. And I pulled over immediately behind him and got out, and he got out of his car. And I said, I don't know if you saw this guy, but, you know, he was doing 100 miles an hour. And it was the closest I've been to being taken out in a long time. And he asked a couple of questions, and I thought, well, that's obviously not going to mean anything, except I thought he might call ahead and say, you know, hey, somebody keep an eye out for this guy. Apparently that isn't the way they work. He got back in his big Suburban, and away he went down the freeway. And I thought, there's no way he's going to catch that Porsche that went by me. And I don't know what his intent was, maybe just to make me feel better, but I got back in my car and went on down the road. But, you know, there are plenty of dangers out there, and they're just as great in terms of your personal life, but they're not as great in terms of the world in which we live. What's going to take out the world in which we live is the economy, is the military conflicts in various parts of the world, is the ultimate conflict between, of course, the King of the South, which we now deeply believe to be the Muslim Islamic hordes of the Central Middle East, and the King of the North that is obviously Europe. So that time is going to come. How soon it's going to come, when it's going to hit, you and I don't know. But we do know it's not going to be very long, because we can see some of this handwriting on the wall. But Jesus said, See that you are not troubled. Part of my intent today, believe it or not, is to encourage us to not be troubled, but to be alert, to be doing what we can to watch and pray and be prepared for it, but not to be troubled, because Jesus Christ and the Father are fully in charge. For all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. So when you and I think we've had enough, he says, the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. And the Greek here can include ethnic groups. So it can be racial, it can be religious, it can be any number of different kinds of warfare. Kingdom and kingdom and nation, and there will be famines, pestilences, earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginning of sorrows. That's scary. It would certainly be scary if you didn't have any faith in God, if you didn't have any trust that Christ was going to intervene. It would be a very scary world. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you. So there will be religious persecution. That's going on against people who are nominal Christians in parts of the world right now. The ISIS army is cleansing the part of Iraq that they hold. And anybody who has called himself a Christian is invited to leave or be beheaded. Then many will be offended, will betray one another, and will hate one another. So when the chips are down, The trouble is that brethren get in a situation where they can't handle the stress, they can't handle the pressure, they can't handle the persecution, they can't handle the level of trials that they're facing, and they respond by, in a sense, bickering among themselves, becoming offended, betraying one another, hating one another, a terrible, terrible time for God's church that all of us want to avoid, that all of us want to be not a part of. We want to be part of God's church that is holding together and loving one another and helping one another and encouraging one another, comforting one another, doing whatever it takes to take care of those who have need. Then many false prophets will rise up and deceive many. There it is again, because in a time of crisis there will be false leaders. And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. See, there's so much sin, it's so common for all these things to happen that, you know, it's kind of out of place to be law-keeping and loving and kind. You get jaded, as I said earlier, by how much stress and pressure you're dealing with in life. And after a while, it's like, well, why should I do that? How many times have you heard, why should I worry about him? Why should I take care of that? Not in the church. I'm talking about in among mankind himself. But we have to be careful because Satan will push that on us. Why should I worry about him? I got enough problems for myself. We cannot let that happen. Verse 13, but he who endures to the end shall be saved. Enduring to the end is still the challenge we all face. We know the truth. We love the truth. We want to be part of God's church. We want to be part of God's kingdom. But we have to hang on, don't we? We have to endure to the end. We have to wait until God delivers us, because we certainly cannot deliver ourselves. We know the scripture in Luke chapter 21, where Christ tells us one of the things we can do and must do. And that is to not allow ourselves to be sucked into the world's ways and to agree with their principles or their approach to life, but rather to guard ourselves against it. Verse 34 of Luke 21:34. But take heed to yourselves, lest your hearts be weighed down with carousing, drunkenness, and cares of this life, and that day come upon you unexpectedly. You see, sin itself can weigh you down and discourage you and frustrate you and end up doing further harm to yourself. We are pretty capable most of the time of fighting that battle. Verse 35, for it will come as a snare on all those who dwell on the face of the whole earth. What? That day, as he describes it the verse before. That day will come on those who dwell on the face of the whole earth as a snare. Watch therefore and pray always. Watch therefore and pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. So he says, don't be taken in a snare. Watch and pray. That watching has to do with watching your own response to the world around you while you're watching what the world is doing. Watching has to do with knowing what's happening. It has to do with being aware of the kinds of threats that I've described for you today in brief. It has to do with being aware of the weaknesses of the human flesh and your own concerns and resisting them and holding fast to what you have been given so that we are not suddenly surprised and taken in a snare. That isn't God's intent. That isn't what God wants for us. God wants for us to hold fast. He wants us to endure to the end. He wants to save us from ourselves. Mankind simply doesn't know the way. Isaiah 59. Isaiah 59, the Apostle Paul quotes this to some degree back in the book of Romans, but we have a long list of things that man does. I'll break into it in the middle of verse 7, or in verse 7. Verse 7, their feet run to evil, and they make haste to shed innocent blood. Their thoughts are thoughts of iniquity. Wasting and destruction are in their paths. The way of peace they have not known. Mankind doesn't have a clue how to make peace. The way of peace they have not known, and there is no justice in their ways. They have made themselves crooked paths. Whoever takes that way shall not know peace. So man is not going to find peace his way. It just isn't going to happen. He cannot bring it. He cannot negotiate it. He cannot establish it by war, by superior military power. Instead, we find in Luke chapter 1, when the announcement to Mary is made, and the announcement to even Elizabeth in the case of John the Baptist. In this case, it's through John to discuss Christ. Verse 76 of Luke 1, speaking to John the Baptist, "And you, child, will be called the prophet of the highest, for you will go before the face of the Lord to prepare his ways, to give knowledge of salvation to his people by the remission of their sins, through the tender mercy of our God, with which the dayspring from on high has visited us," that is Christ, of course, "to give light to those who sit in darkness and the shadow of death, to guide our feet into the way of peace." Christ's role is to guide man's feet into the way of peace, and man isn't willing to listen. He's going to have to be taught, and he's going to have to be corrected and brought to humble dependence upon God before God finally delivers him. But God will deliver him to peace. But only God knows the way to peace. Christ is the ambassador of peace. Let's go to 2 Corinthians chapter 1. Again, we could talk about this for hours, I'm sure, but I just want to hit a couple of highlights again to remind us that we have confidence and faith and trust that God is in fact going to deliver us. 2 Corinthians chapter 1. I read this verse not because it's dealing directly with our situation that we're talking about, but because it describes God's attitude. 2 Corinthians 1, verse 3. "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of mercies and God of all comfort, who comforts us in all our tribulation, that we may be able to comfort those who are in any trouble." So God himself comforts us, and we're supposed to be able to offer comfort to those who are in trouble. Now, sometimes they don't receive the comfort that we offer, and sometimes they can't even begin to understand the comfort we offer, but we can often reassure them that there is a way out and that there is going to be a positive solution with the comfort with which we ourselves are comforted by God. That would tend to involve the truth, because the comfort with which you and I are comforted from God is the knowledge of his plan, the knowledge of his purpose, the knowledge that sooner or later Christ is going to return and all this is going to come to an end. And then the world is going to change and change dramatically. So our job is to watch. Our job is to pray for discernment and wisdom. Our job is to receive the comfort that God gives us in faith, knowing that he is going to work it out for us and that he's going to work out man's problems for the benefit ultimately of all of mankind. And our job also is to hold on to what we know and not let Satan deceive us and take us away from the truth. Revelation chapter 3, we used to go here frequently in the early days of the church because, of course, we had a strong confidence that this era of the church was the equivalent of the Philadelphia era of the church back in the early days in the apostolic age. And so we come to Revelation chapter 3, talking to the Philadelphia church. He says in verse 10, "Because you have kept my command to persevere, I also will keep you from the hour of trial which shall come upon the whole world to test those who dwell on the earth." So God says, I'll keep you from that hour of trial. Now, some of that will happen in what we call the place of safety, no doubt, where there will literally be a place to preserve God's people from the face of the devil. But some of it will no doubt be in the spiritual, mental comfort and capacity to deal with the issues wherever we might be. Verse 11, "Behold, I am coming quickly." That certainly applies to us today. "Behold, I am coming quickly. Hold fast what you have, that no one may take your crown." Hold it fast. Don't let it slip. Don't give it up. Don't let it be taken away. Let's go then finally to John chapter 16, I think I read this just a couple of weeks ago, but it seems the only logical place to leave you in such an environment of the chaos and the misery and the tribulation and the troubles that we all face day in and day out in our society and what we can see is coming upon mankind. Verse 31 of John 16. Jesus answered them, "Do you now believe? Indeed, the hour is coming, yes, has now come, that you will be scattered, each to his own, and will leave me alone." And as you know, that happened with the disciples. "And yet I am not alone, because the Father is with me. These things I have spoken to you, that in me you may have peace. In the world you will have tribulation. Be of good cheer, I have overcome the world." So we've progressed from "don't be troubled" to "be of good cheer." Big enough challenge to not be troubled. But Christ's word, and therefore God's spirit in us, says not only don't be troubled, but be of good cheer because I have overcome the world. So our hope, our comfort, our understanding of what's happening in the world is based entirely on the fact that God has called us to be his people. He has given us his spirit. We are going to be in his family, and Christ is going to return soon to make that happen. So in the midst of frustration and worry and fear and discouragement, which we all feel from time to time, hopefully we can take heart in the words of Christ, be of good cheer.